Bueno, seguimos aquí en el Twitch oficial de Radio Primavera Sound y ahora vamos a cambiar de idioma para hablar en inglés porque tenemos sección literaria con Ben Cardew que va a entrevistar a Will Hodgkinson.
Yes, Will, don't worry, you don't have to speak Spanish. I mean, maybe you do speak Spanish.
I wish I could.
So I'm really, really excited about this interview because as everyone here will attest, I've been going on about this book quite a lot since I read it. The book has just come out in Spanish as well. It's called Superestrella de las Calles, Un Año con Lawrence. It's by Will Hodgkinson, who is the chief rock and pop critic for The Times, also contributes to Mojo magazine, written for loads and loads of people, done loads of books. But this book is really, really, really quite special. Will, how are you doing?
I'm good, thank you very much. Yeah, thank you for having me.
No, it's a real pleasure. I was saying before we went on air that your book was introduced to me by Simon Raymond as being one of the best books ever written about music. And I have to say, it's absolutely excellent. So Lawrence, for people who don't know, once of Felt, a very cult indie group. I knew him initially through Denim because that was kind of when I was growing up. Now with Go-Kart Mozart, or Mozart Estate, I believe they're now called.
That's the latest, yeah.
And he is a very unique person. I mean, well, how would you describe Lawrence to anyone who doesn't know?
I describe him as a pop star monk. He's monastic in his approach to life. He's had a lot of drug problems, but he doesn't smoke, or he does smoke. What am I talking about? He doesn't drink. He's pretty much celibate. He's got all these routines to his life, you know, lots of rituals, the way things he has to do, the way he has to control things. But at the same time, he wants to be a world famous pop star. Having said that, I wonder, this is something he disagrees with, I wonder if he wants to be a world famous pop star in his dreams as opposed to his reality. Because if you are Chris Martin or Mick Jagger or any of these people, Lady Gaga, you have to make compromises all the time. You have to do things you don't necessarily want to do. You have to go on children's television. You have to do lots of interviews or the rest of it. Whereas Lawrence likes being an enigma. So he says that he wants to be this huge world famous star and he wants to be incredibly rich and live in a mansion. But I wonder if in reality he likes being a underground cult star, which he says he doesn't like. And you know, and if that's the place for him in a way. Yeah. So he's a very enigmatic, very good songwriter. Very, very talented, but a complex person, a difficult person who, in a way, it wasn't built for normal life.
At what point did you discover that he'd be an interesting subject to dedicate a book to?
I met him about 20 years ago, and at the time it would have been impossible because he was a heroin addict back then and he was in a really bad way. It was shortly before he was made homeless, and it was kind of the worst period of his life. So I always knew he was interesting and very funny, very charming, but difficult. What happened was it was suggested, I guess, at the end of the lockdown, must have been 2022, my publisher, a guy called Pete Selby, said, would you be interested in doing a book on Lawrence? And I said, well, not really, because as much as I love him and as interesting he is, I think it would just be too impossible. But we had a meeting and Lawrence said, I don't want to do a memoir. And I was thinking, great, I don't want to write your memoir, you know. and then he said, well, what about, I'd be interested in doing a book which is completely set in the present and you follow me around for a year. And the funny thing was, this is classic Lawrence. So his examples were, he gave me a book called The Duke in His Domain, which is by Truman Capote. And it's about trying to get an interview with Marlon Brando. The other book he gave me is called Mr. Sinatra Has a Cold, and it's about following around, trying to get an interview with Frank Sinatra by a guy called Gay Talese. Now, spot the problem. Marlon Brando, Frank Sinatra, very, very famous, didn't give an interview. And I'm thinking, but Lawrence, nobody's heard of you. And if you try to not give me an interview, I'm just going to tell you to get lost. So we ended up having came to this kind of compromise, where I'd say, well, look, I want to tell your life story because it's fascinating. But let me see how the world interacts with you and how you interact with the world, because he doesn't have any money. So, you know, he really does wander around, you know, poor areas of London, looking for inspiration, drinking cups of milky tea. One time we took all the coins. He had a big pile of coins and we took them to the machine in the bank to try and get about £30, you know, it's like, what, 35 euros or something, you know. So all these different things that I was observing someone as they live their life, and that's really what the book is about.
I have an absolutely burning question to ask after reading this book, because I can work it out. Is Lawrence happy? I mean, obviously, things vary from day to day, but on the whole, because I could not work it out. On the one hand, he you know, it seems to be quite a difficult life, you know, he doesn't have money, he has to sort of take back two pences and things. On the other, he's doing exactly what he wants.
Well, you've really coined the contradiction. He said that every now and then he had people who said that they were jealous of him. You know, I think there's some pop star who'd be more successful would say, why is everybody always writing about Lawrence? Why are they fascinating about Lawrence? And he said, would anybody want my life? You know, I do not have a nice life. He has absolutely no money whatsoever. He's got no partner. He's got no family. He falls out with most people. But at the same time, I think for the kind of person he is and the sort of, he's got, you know, mental health problems, essentially. I think he's realized the kind of life that he can lead, if you know what I mean. So he's realized that he can do some concerts. He can do a little bit of touring in Europe, but he can't go off around America. He's just not capable. You know, he can go each day, he can have his routines, and he's sort of worked out what is right for him. And he has an interesting life because he's very interested in life. So he's a big reader. He's really interested in books. He's really interested in, and this is where he differs from a lot of real pop stars. He's really interested in the people he meets on a day-to-day basis. It could be the person working at the coffee shop. It could be the guy who is, you know, cleaning the rubbish. It could be a millionaire. He doesn't really, he really is curious about people. So he kind of goes through life on, that's why he's a, I call the book Street Level Superstar. You know, he goes through life on a kind of unobtrusive level and is interested in what he sees every day.
It's interesting you bring up mental illness, because I don't think I'd really thought of him that way. And then there's a moment in the book where Michaela, one of his ex-girlfriends, who talks quite a lot about him and talks very, very very interestingly about him, she says that he allowed mental illness to take over. And I hadn't thought about that. I mean, I just wonder if you could sort of expand on that, like how is his sort of mental health? I mean, you know, or how do you think he is? What did Michaela mean by that?
What she meant was that when she met him, it was in the early days of Denim. And this was when he had the possibility of being very successful. And she realized that in the years before, when he was with Felt, who were a cool band, but not a big band, he had quite a normal life. You know, he had girlfriends. He had a flat. He'd managed to buy a flat. He'd done all these things, which, you know, normal people do. And it hadn't been a problem. So I think I agree with her to an extent. But I think what I saw with Lawrence, and this is the funny thing, because he hates the idea of being diagnosed. A lot of people have since said, well, he's autistic. And he says, I'm not autistic. I'm just different. You know, he doesn't like the idea of being diagnosed. And I would say he's obsessive compulsive. He gets so obsessed with details that it almost ruins his life. And I think that's why he hasn't been more successful, because there's always some detail that isn't right. So he stops things from happening. And it was the same with the book. You know, the things he complained about were tiny details, tiny. We had a 2-hour argument because he wanted to become friends with in North London, there's a big Orthodox Jewish community. And he's fascinated by them, and he wanted to become friends with him. It's never going to happen, but, you know, he wanted to be part of the community. And he said that he went to visit a shop where the men get the big hats, you know, the big black hats. And there's an area in London called Golders Green, And about a mile away is an area called Stamford Hill. And he went crazy because I said in the book that the hat shop he visited was in Golders Green, and when it was actually in Stamford Hill. Now, nobody else would care. But to him, this was like, the book can't come out until this is correct. I was like, okay, I'll change it. And then he was like, no. It's wrong. I said, yes, fine, I'll change it. It's like, no, you don't understand. He kind of can't get beyond things.
Yeah. See, that was what I was wondering. Like, did he demand, like, total approval over the copy in the end? I mean, because you couldn't give it to him. It would never come out. But we're like, how? Yeah, what was the relationship? I know you mentioned the epilogue that you give him a copy of the book and he reads it. But like, yeah, how did it happen? Did you just have to say, look, no, sorry, you can't?
It's very much so. Very much so. I had to do that. I had, at the very beginning, I said to Lawrence, okay, if we're going to do this, you're going to have to let me do it. And then he said, he gave me a list of rules. And he said, no use of my surname. It's like, okay, fine, I won't use your surname, that's fine. No talking to the other people in Felt. Now, the reason he didn't want me to talk to the other people in Felt is because he's got his version of events and they would have theirs. And initially I thought, well, that's ridiculous. But then the more I thought about it, I thought, no, actually it's okay, because I'm spending this year with him, and whoever comes into it, like the old girlfriends, like Michaela, that's kind of okay. But I'm not doing a normal memoir. So, it's okay to have his version, his kind of, or my view. But in terms of approval, no, he wanted to. He kept asking me. He said, you've got to show me the chapters. I said, I'm not going to. And we had arguments about that. And he said, well, it's going to be terrible for you because I'm going to have so many changes. It's like, you're not having loads of changes. You know, it's not happening. And then he read it. Initially, he read the first chapter and he was really upset. He said, you're laughing at me. And I said, read on. Don't just read the first chapter. I'm not laughing at you. I'm not putting up with your nonsense, but there's a lot of affection there. And I think anyone could see that when they read the book. And when he finally read the whole thing, he said he loved it and he was very touched by it. But then all the tiny detail changes came along. And that's when we had lots of fights. But if I got things wrong, that was fine. You know, if I got a date wrong, I'd be happy to change it.
I've got to say that I have a lot more respect for him. Not that I didn't have respect, but like, since reading the book, I think it's really helped with his legend. And I went back to listen to a lot of Felt, which I hadn't done for a very long time. One thing in the book, and I get to the end, I couldn't remember if this came up. There's a cheese omelette anecdote that he does not want in the book. And I was like, did you put in the book? I can't remember.
I didn't actually. So basically that's the big, what's the word? You know, the kind of the blind alley of the book. Okay, so Michaela said to me this anecdote about a cheese omelette. And she said, she's talking about how, you know, because she really hates him, which is great, because she was very, very horrible about him, which is really good because she also really understands him. And he was great about that. He didn't. I mean, can you imagine doing a memoir on Bruce Springsteen and, you know, having his old girlfriend say, yeah, he's a complete idiot, he's terrible at sex, the whole thing was a nightmare. Yeah, it's not going to happen, you know. So, he was amazing in that respect. The omelette, the cheese omelette is a kind of, the story is never emerges. It's I respected Lawrence's wishes, although he didn't want the cheese omelette mentioned at all. And it's like, well, no, the cheese omelette's being mentioned. I'm just not going to say what happened to the cheese with the cheese omelette.
See,
and I still haven't.
I'm sort of one of the things that really made me think, like in the book, there's a lot of, as you say, walking around London. And maybe you're a lot more patient than me, but I think at sometimes I would have just been tempted to be like, I don't know, to like buy him something or give him money for something or like just change it, which would have changed things in some way. You know what I mean? Like, was there that, was it quite hard to resist? Not just be like, okay, Lawrence, I'll buy you this jacket or whatever, or, you know, I'll get you lots of cups of tea or something like that.
Well, I definitely know. I did pay for all those cups of tea.
Okay, right.
Yeah. I didn't mention that. So he's funny about money, actually. I said to him, well, what I'm going to do with this book is, because I'm writing about you, and it wouldn't happen without your, you know, your unique worldview, I will give you half the royalties, but I'm taking the advance. And the advance wasn't that much, but, you know, you have to, I couldn't afford to do it for nothing. So he was fine about that. He didn't demand anything. He's odd about money. He's sort of quite happy. He didn't demand much. He didn't ask for much. So, you know, we'll be walking about and, you know, he doesn't really eat. I mean, there's a chapter which the Spanish publisher really liked when he, in the days of Felt, he had a Spanish girlfriend in Barcelona called, how do you say, Angels?
Angela is Angels in Catalan.
Okay, so she's Angels, yeah, which he called it the Basque region. It's, of course, the Catalan region. But so this girl, he said that we had an amazing night. She was a DJ. And she picked him up on her Vespa and took him around all the beautiful sights of Barcelona and had this incredible night. And then it all went wrong because they thought this one night stand was going to be a great romance. And he came back to Barcelona and she was going, eat something. And he wouldn't eat anything. He said, eventually, he said, I'll have one of the thin steaks that they do in Spain. I don't quite know what he means, but anyway, he said, no chips. You can't make chips in Spain. Nonsense. anyway, so he said, that's it. And they had a massive, massive round. They split up over food because she couldn't believe that, you know, because Spanish food, you know, and she couldn't believe that this guy wouldn't eat anything when she presented it to him. So that was the end of the relationship. He's very funny about food. He's funny about lots of things. He doesn't really like natural things, you know. He likes books and culture, but he doesn't like nature, birds, animals, physical relationships, food, anything sort of physical he doesn't really like.
Do you think like much of this is sort of a mask he's putting on, or is it just literally he's like that?
When you meet him, which I hope you will one day, you'll realise nobody is that clever to make a mask like that. It's too, people, a lot of people have said that. He's very aware of his own image. He did, so for example, he kept going on and on about, he told everyone how much he loved Lana Del Rey. And he said, yeah, she's made my favourite albums of all time. And I know that he doesn't have any contact with the internet, so he doesn't have Spotify or anything. He only listens to music on vinyl. So I went round to his flat one day, and there was Lana Del Rey's album, still in its polythene. He hadn't listened to it once. He liked the idea of her, you know. So,
well, he's like a performance artist in a way, isn't he?
He is. He is in a way. It's not conscious, but everything, you know, so for example, when... For most of us, the worst nightmare in life would be to be made homeless. And, you know, this is when he had a big drug problem. So he was really homeless. You know, he was on the streets for a few nights. And he's talking about that time with me. And he said, well, I knew it was going to make a great anecdote. So it's almost like everything is an anecdote.
Well, that's the other thing. I was expecting quite a bleak book. And there are some very, you know, difficult moments, like in being homeless, like the kind of drug addiction. But it's not bleak at all. I mean, was that like a conscious effort, or did that just kind of come out through what you were covering?
It came out because Lawrence is very, very funny. You know, he's very entertaining, and so it's not really bleak to be with him because he's moody. You know, he can be in a bad mood and then everything is terrible. But when he's in a good mood, and you're walking around, you know, because he sees things that people don't see all the time. You know, he's always fascinated by things in supermarkets, shop names, the kids at the bus stop, you know, all this sort of stuff. He's always observing little things. And so it's very entertaining being with him. But also it wasn't bleak because to me, Lawrence is a bit of a hero. You know, we all worry about what we're going to do with our lives. And we think, oh, you know, I should have done this, I should have done that. He doesn't have any of that. He doesn't worry about mortgages or children or relationships or anything. He's just very selfish. But, you know, he's on this mission to be whatever he is, this kind of performance art, pop star, songwriter figure. And everything else plays second fiddle. So he doesn't care.
Oh, the connection. The connection has slightly cut, I will just take advantage to say that the book is out now via Contra in Spanish. It's called Superestrella de las Calles, Un Año con Lawrence. And yeah, you can buy it now. It's also available in English through 5/8, who are an excellent publisher. One thing I did very much want to ask is if they're going to be doing like a Spanish launch or something like that.
Ah, oh, there you are.
Okay. I didn't know what happened there.
No idea. Technological things. But yeah, I was just asking, what do you think, like, how do you think, like, history will remember Lawrence?
I think history will remember Lawrence a little bit like Nick Drake. Maybe Nick Drake was not known, if not successful. Maybe a bit different because Nick Drake's music is very, very beautiful. And so it ended up on car adverts and things, you know. It might be harder, but then having said that, a lot of Felt's music is very beautiful. Primitive Painters is a very beautiful song, you know. So it's possible. I mean, I think he will be remembered as a very eccentric and unusual, very original cult figure, very, very talented. I think he will be. I mean, his, you know, he loves people like Van Gogh, and he loves a Norwegian writer called Knut Hamsun, who wasn't very successful in his lifetime, but had written this book called Hunger, which is all about a starving artist, you know. So I think he will be remembered because the body of work is impressive. And the other thing about Lawrence is that he has actually, for all his problems, he has actually been very productive. You know, Felt made 10 albums in 10 years. Denim made 3. Mm. And then Mozart Estate and Go-Kart Mozart, probably about 5 or 6 now. So that's quite a big body of work. You know, it's not, yeah.
No, I was going to ask how it's been sort of selling the book to the wider public, because it is a book that I would encourage anyone to read, whether you've even heard of Lawrence or not. But like, he's like a sort of cult hero. How's it been like trying to get the word out? Do you have to like explain to people who Lawrence is and like why he's so important?
Well, the surprise has been the response. You know, I really, really felt that this was a labor of love. And that it would be something that, you know, I'd do, and I'd do it when I could over the year. It would come out, and I felt confident about it. It's a strange book, you know, it's not a normal structure. So I felt that people would discover it slowly, and it would be word of mouth. And that's my best hope. But almost instantly, in fact, even before it came out, there was something. I don't know what it is. You know, if I could know, I'd do it again. You know, there was something that people were talking about as soon as they started reading early copies. And so the press jumped on it, and it was reviewed everywhere. And then it's been in the book of the year for Rough Trade, Rough Trade Records, and then Book of the Year for Mojo, Book of the Year for Uncut. This all just happened. So I haven't had to do much. It's just, you know, people seem to have responded to it. And I think the reason they have is not, obviously Lawrence is fascinating, but he's fairly unknown. I think what's interesting is the idea of sacrifice, somebody who in the eyes of the world, they might have failed. You know, they might have they tried to become famous and they didn't succeed. But there's something very poignant about somebody who never gives up, you know, and I think that's what attracted people to the story. This person, this strange person who's in the world but not in the world, he's slightly separate. That's what I mean about like a monk pop star. And I think I couldn't have seen it coming. I really couldn't, but I haven't had to push too hard. And I felt I shouldn't push too hard because he is an obscure figure. It's not like I'm doing a book on Oasis. I mean, you know, it had to come out gently. I couldn't force it or try and over-promote it, but it's really happened naturally.
Do you think he will ever have that worldwide hit that he's always, well, he says he's always wanted to have? I mean, like there's a big bit in towards the latter end of the book in which he's like, I've got this song. It's going to be the song that does it. I've temporarily forgot the name of it, but it refers to
Delivery.
Oh, yes. Yeah. is he ever going to have that hit, do you think?
I mean, I think it's more likely that he will have an old song that will become the modern day hits. So hits now don't go to number one, do they? But songs like, okay, well, I mean, look at the Kate Bush phenomenon. Kate Bush was very successful, obviously. But, you know, that then it was reborn. But there are a few, there are people who aren't so well known, you know, whose songs get rediscovered. I mean, Suicide, the New York band, they were really, they had a really hard time in the early days, and punk didn't understand them, you know. Yeah. I mean, Dream Baby Dream is kind of a song that people know now, you know, that Gen Z knows, and, you know, people know that song. So I think it could happen with one of the really great older songs like Primitive Painters or Sunlight Bathed the Golden Glow, which is a great felt song, or maybe some of the Denim songs. There's a great song called The Osmonds, which is a really beautiful song. So I think it could happen, but I think it's going to be one of the older ones.
But the thing is, his lifestyle and his iconic look, you know, first of all, Gen Z really loves these kind of outsider characters. Well, every kind of generation has had, you know, people who we like the people on the outskirts, no, the doomed, tortured artists. I don't think it will take long before you start getting offers to get turn this into a film or a series or a documentary.
Well, there's already a really good documentary, yeah.
And that'll make him become like a household name, won't it? I mean, it'll, you know.
That'd be great. That could happen. I mean, I think it could happen that he would be a, it could be a fictionalized version of this story. Hmm.
I would watch the hell out of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think a lot of us would. I mean, who knows? You know, I'm naturally, Lawrence is very pessimistic and I'm kind of pessimistic just because, you know, I've done 5-6 books and every time something happens and it all seems great and then reality hits. But so far this book has already done much more than either of us expected. Yeah. I mean, it started, the year started with Lawrence releasing an album as Mozart Estate, and it's a great album, and it sold nothing. You know, this was in January 2023, and he was really disappointed, and he was saying, I don't understand it, it's not in record shops, no one seems to be able to get it. You know, it just kind of disappeared without trace. So he was very used to disappointment, and that was another theme of the book in a way. I think there's a theme of disappointment running through, and a thin sliver of hope. You know, this is why the next song is always going to be the number one smash hit.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you. Thank you so much. I know you've won Mojo, Rough Trade and Uncut Book of the Year, but I'll also give you my music book of the year, which is not slightly less influential, sadly. But,
I disagree. But yeah,
I love when you go to a very famous book selling website, which I'm not going to mention because they don't need extra publicity. But it's one of the quotes is, Will has finally written his masterpiece. I'm glad I could be of assistance, Lawrence.
Yeah, exactly. Perfect, you know.
One final thing. Obviously, it's out on Contra, who are great.
In Spanish.
Yeah, in Spanish, as Super Estrella de las Calles, Un Año con Lawrence. Do you have any plans for like a Spanish launch? Come over, do readings or anything?
Definitely. I really want to. So Contra has said that they have suggested the Mozart Estate do a concert, I think probably starting off in Barcelona, and then take it from there. And we do a concert, I mean, Mozart Estate do a concert, and then we do a little launch, you know, so do a reading, an interview, whatever, you know, do something like that. I would absolutely love to do it. Contra really want to do it. It's getting Lawrence and the band. You know, he's got a really good band as well now. He's got really, really great band. They're young, but they've all got jobs, you know, because there's not really any money in Mozart Estate. So if we could make that happen, it won't be this year now, I think. It's unlikely, but it'd be lovely to make it happen in the spring. So, yeah, I really hope that will happen.
Fingers crossed. They did that with Mickey Berenyi's book, actually.
They did reading
followed by concert, and it was a really, really kind of fabulous event. So hopefully the same thing will happen.
That'd be superb.
Oh, so someone's saying something on the chat. That's it.
Sally Coronet is very excited by the idea of concerts by Go-Kart Mozart.
But it's Mozart Estate now.
Yeah, it's Mozart Estate.
Yeah. Oh, and No, oh no, Rombo versus what's this? Rombo
no, that's about the earlier gig.
Oh, okay.
Well, thank you so much. I really, really hope you come to Barcelona. I will definitely go to the gig reading. I genuinely mean it when I say my music book of the year. Go and read it in English, Spanish, or whatever. And thank you so much for speaking to us today.
Oh, well, thanks for having me. And I hope to meet both of you guys in Spain when Mozart State take over the world.
Yes, we'll be here.
We'll manifest that.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Front row. Bye.
Yep. Take care. Bye.